Mark chapter 10, let's read here tonight, verse number 27. We're going to find in this verse and four more like it that we will reference the word impossible. Mark chapter 10, just reading this one verse in verse number 27. And Jesus, looking upon them, saith, with men it is impossible, but not with God. For with God all things are possible. Then again it is repeated in Matthew 19, the same wording or the same sentiment, Luke chapter 1. Luke chapter 18 says, and he said, the things which are impossible with men are possible with God. The word impossible means unable to be done, without strength, or powerless. And really, it's a word that we don't much care for. To be told that something is impossible, especially in this society, if you're a man or a boy, is just like an invitation to give it a try. We don't like the word impossible because it seems to imply some degree of lacking on our part. It seems to point out our shortcomings, our lack of power or ability. But as we read this verse, we notice that the impossible is clearly part of our life each and every day, because in verse 27 it says, with men it is impossible. Which means that there are things that we face that are unable to be done. Means that there are things that we are without strength or we are powerless to do or to carry out. I know that if I take this pen in my pocket tonight and let it go from my hand, it's going to fall to the ground. I know that because God has said and put into place that there is gravity that will cause this pen to fall towards the ground at, if I remember right, like 9.82 meters per second squared. I don't know. Seems like I remember that. So I know that's going to happen. But if you task me with the responsibility of sticking this pin out and causing it to go up instead of down, without any assistance, or without any other external forces acting upon it, it's impossible, isn't it? It's something that can't be done. It's something that, with men, is an impossibility. Just consider our extremities, our limits, our finite inabilities. And it's not hard to see that with men things are impossible. As we saw this morning from Hebrews 11 and verse number 6, it is even impossible with men to please God apart from faith. So that which is impossible is surrounding us always. Should not surprise us. It's a part of life. So here's the question that we want to focus on and think about tonight. So then what happens when God asks the impossible of us? Feeling very confident that the impossible does exist because we see it in these four or five verses in the Gospels. We're reminded of it in Hebrews 11 that there is an impossibility of pleasing God. What happens when God commands, when He leads, when He directs, or when He expects us to do that which we are powerless to do? Things that we are without strength to perform. Things that we are powerless to bring to pass. You say, why even frame the question that way? Why even ask it? It needs to be asked, it needs to be thought upon, because God asks the impossible of us all the time. He asks the impossible of His people all the time. The thought is often conveyed to people, especially in times of difficulty, especially in times of loss or in times of trial. God will not give you more than you can handle. The thought that God will not ask us to do more than we are able to do, or God will not give us more than we can bear. Really, at the heart, that seems like a very biblical statement. It seems like something that is well-intentioned and meant to comfort and meant to encourage someone else, but really it's a lie from Satan that he wants you to believe. Satan wants you to believe that everything that you encounter is possible for you to overcome and for you to do on your own. That's what Satan wants. And you may think that's harsh about that statement because that's not really what people mean per se. But that's the thought, or that's the belief that it leads to. If you honestly believe that there is nothing, or God would not put anything in your life that is impossible for you to complete and for you to overcome on your own power, then what? You have a very elevated view of who you are, what your abilities are, and it leads to pride, it leads to sin, and does way more harm than good. God does ask us every day for the impossible. He says, this is what I want you to do. This is what I am putting in your path today. This is what I am calling you to do and to be. And it is an impossibility with men for us to do, for us to be, and for us to bring those things to pass. Just like I can't make that pin go upward without assistance from something else. The problem is that if we allow that mentality, if we allow that idea that we can't accomplish anything on our own, then it will lead to failure. He asks us to handle things that are impossible. He calls us to serve in ways that we are truly powerless to complete. He calls us to acts that we simply cannot be successful in. And we want to take these examples tonight from Scripture to show you exactly what we mean, that God does ask the impossible. So what happens when that comes to pass? When our extremities, when our limits, when our finite abilities or inabilities meet the commands of God, it's like the immovable force meeting the immovable object. What's going to happen? How can we possibly be successful with these things that are impossible with men? Go with me to Daniel chapter 3. We are not the only of God's people that have had to find an answer to this question. What happens when God asks the impossible? We have not, or are not, the only generation that has had to face God giving to us day after day after day things that are power, or that we are powerless to complete and bring to pass. We're not the only ones. And here are but a few examples. In Daniel chapter 3, we find three Hebrews and a king who thinks he's a god and is deserved to be treated that way. If you think about it, God asked the impossible from these men. We read about them all through the first few chapters of the book of Daniel. These men who were children when they were extracted from their home, forced to live amongst the heathen, forced or at least tried to coerce to accept their ways, were forced to grow up under the rule of Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. Impossible task number one was for them to honor God in the midst of the heathen that surrounded them. God brought them to this place under captivity. Nebuchadnezzar's idea was to raise them up as his next advisors and his a place of wisdom and help and all of this, to train them in the ways of the Chaldeans and all of that. But God said unto them, they knew already when they went, that our job, our duty is to honor God in the midst of this heathen land under the conditions that we are forced to live under in this captivity. Now, as God commands this, as God brings this to them, it is an impossibility. They are powerless. And yet they accomplish it. This they managed to do in chapter 1 as they refused the king's meat. became favored by the one that was overseeing them and eventually by the king himself. While not sacrificing their beliefs, they never gave them up. They accomplished that impossible task that they were given. You say, well, that really doesn't sound too hard. Impossible task number two. After a space of time, these men were proven worthy. They were given responsibility in the kingdom. Daniel was placed as really what you might call the president. And then we see these three men were set up as governors, or three of the highest ranking officials underneath Daniel in Babylon. They had great responsibility. They had great power. Impossible task number two was not being corrupted by the power that came with that calling. By not turning from everything that they had ever believed and enriching themselves off of the worship of the gods of the Chaldeans, or of turning to the things that were readily available to them because no one would tell them no. We see that they maintained their beliefs, and they became powerful in the kingdom. And then the third and most notable impossible task was when they were called to bow down to this statue of Nebuchadnezzar. We know that he created this statue to honor and glorify himself as the God of the earth. That's how he saw himself. And so he created this statue for that purpose. He calls together a great assembly. This assembly included Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, these three Hebrew men who have so far done the impossible throughout the course of their lives. They're no longer children. They're men. Men that have grown up serving God, honoring God, and putting God first in a crooked, heathen, blasphemous nation. They had already done the impossible. They were called to this place to set an example. Now, as you review the events here in Daniel 3, the whole kingdom wasn't present at this location at this time. They couldn't be. There would have been too many people for one location. But it appears that as Nebuchadnezzar called and instituted this worship of himself, that he took the ones that were in authority. We'll take the time tonight to read through there, but read the beginning of chapter 3. Those that were princes and those that were governors, those that were in authority were the ones that were called. Why? Because if they did it, so too would the rest of those under their authority. That's why Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were here. They're influential in the kingdom. Nebuchadnezzar said, bow down to the statue when you hear the music. And they were faced with an impossible choice. God put the weight upon them of this impossible decision, of this impossible task, to honor and glorify Him in the midst of all the heathen. They'd been doing that, but now things were different. Notice here, verse 13, as they were found out, they refused to bow down in the midst of the crowd. Then notice in verse 13, then Nebuchadnezzar in his rage and fury commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, do not ye serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up? Now if ye be ready, that at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the image which I have made well. But if ye worship not, ye shall be cast the same hour into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? What an impossible thing to be put in this situation. It's one thing to be in the midst of a crowd and not bow. Of course, everyone being down on their knees, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were standing tall. And certainly they were seen. They were found out. They were brought to the king. Now they weren't surrounded by the crowds, but they still had to stand tall. but an impossible task. With men, this was impossible. They were powerless to do it. They could not bring it to pass. But we see in verse number 16 in their answer that they were successful in the impossible. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. He will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods nor worship the gold image which thou hast set up. They were faced with the decision to blaspheme God and live, or honor God and die. What an impossible thing. How can a man make that decision? How can he honor God in that way? They were put in an impossible position. We stand in awe of what they did. They chose the fiery furnace. They chose to not bow. They didn't buckle. They stood tall. They did the impossible. They were successful in what God had laid before them, that impossible task. The question is for us to think about is what did they have that we do not? We stand in awe of what they did in accomplishing the impossible. What did they have that we do not have? I'll tell you, they did not have anything nor possess anything that we do not. We understand that they were asked to do the impossible by God, and repeatedly they did exactly that. They accomplished it. And you and I can too. Because what brought them through and caused them to do the impossible, their response when God asked, God commanded, God led, God showed them to do the impossible, their response, and what made them successful was the same thing that will make us successful. Let's look at another example. Turn to 1 Samuel 17. 1 Samuel chapter number 17, the Lord also brought us here in the consideration of when He asks the impossible, what transpires, what takes place, to consider a boy and a defiant giant. A boy, not even a man, not even a soldier. We see in 1 Samuel chapter 17, in verse number 4, that there was an impossible task put before Saul and the armies of Israel. 1 Samuel 17:4, and there went out a champion out of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits in a span. As we continue to read there, we find out that he was 9.5 foot tall, his armor weighed something ridiculous, like 30 or 50 pounds. He had a spear alone that weighed 20 pounds like a weaver's beam. It was ridiculous. This man among men. We read and understand that he came morning and evening for 40 days. He challenged the armies of Israel to send out a man to fight him, to beat him, to take him down. And Saul and the armies of Israel faced with an impossible task, because who could defeat a man like that? Who could take out the giant? Who could slay him that has killed thousands? Who could slay him that is head and shoulders above the rest, even Saul, who was tall himself? We see for 40 days, Saul and his armies failed to do the impossible. Why? Because they were powerless against the giant. They didn't have any power. Enter a boy coming to check on his brother, sent on an errand by his father, a keeper of sheep. As he enters the scene, we see in verse number 10, actually before he enters the scene, and the Philistine said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. When Saul and all Israel heard those words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. They were failing. They were powerless. They were instead of accomplishing the impossible, doing the opposite. With men, this is impossible. That is shown clearly. 40 days it went on. Then notice in verse 32. After the entrance of this boy named David that had ran on an errand from his fathers to check on his brethren to come to this place, leaving his sheep behind. Verse 32, and David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Thy servant will go and fight with this Philistine." God had laid it upon David's heart to do the impossible. When he heard that the armies of Israel, the great soldiers that were battle-hardened, had allowed this man to defy the armies of Israel, blaspheme the God of heaven for 40 days, David was incensed. He says, "Is there not a cause? Is there not a cause here?" And of course there was. And immediately David had laid upon his heart by God to do the impossible. In other words, God came knocking. And the task that was laid on David's heart was something that was impossible for him to do. It would have been miraculous enough had it been the most elite soldier from among the ranks of Saul's army. It would have been miraculous enough if it was just a foot soldier, one that had just joined the fight. No, it wasn't even any of that, was it? It was a boy, a keeper of sheep. And yet he was poised and resolute to take the fight to the giant. He explains to Saul further down here that, I think it's in verse 37, he explains to Saul that he'd had some experiences. He'd fought a lion. He'd fought a bear. He had been in some scrapes. And so he had something to affirm to him that he had some ability. But in reality, this was an impossible task for this boy. There is nothing in the physical description of David, in his life, in his experiences, in who he is, in what he was, there is nothing to say that David had any power to do this. It was impossible for David to take on this giant and win. God called the boy David to do an impossible thing. So what does David do? He says, "I'll do it. I'll do it. I will go and fight with this Philistine." We know he grabs his 5 stones, puts them in his sack. He goes off. After shedding Saul's armor because it cumbered him about and held him up, he said, "I don't need this. I'll go and fight without a sword." All he had was a sling. Verse 45. Then said David to the Philistine, "Thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield. But I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. This day will the Lord deliver thee into mine hand. And I will smite thee, and I will give the carcass of the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel." And we know that David did exactly that. He came in the name of the Lord, and the impossible was accomplished. Imagine the thought as the giant fell to the ground after receiving one shot from David's sling. He falls to the ground. An impossible shot. An impossible result from the might of David in slinging this little stone. Yet we see God called on David to do the impossible, and David did it. So when God calls upon us to do the impossible, what is the answer or what is the result? What happens when God asks the impossible? That's what we're considering. What did David have that we do not have? What did David possess that gave him the belief, that gave him the conviction, that gave him the understanding that this was the right thing to do at this moment, no matter the consequences? What gave him that? Because that makes the difference between carrying out the impossible and being overcome or failing. Let's look at one more example. Go back to Genesis 22. If there ever was an impossible task given to a parent here, given to a father, what we find here in Genesis 22 certainly does apply. We read here just the first couple of verses. You know all of these examples so very well. But notice what is said here in Genesis 22 in verse number 1. And it came to pass after these things that God did tempt Abraham. He said unto him, Abraham, and he said, Behold, here am I. And he said, Take now thy son, thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains, which I will tell thee of. God asked the impossible here of him, didn't he? How could a parent ever sacrifice their child? How could they ever take him up a mount, lay him on an altar, slit his throat, drain him of his blood, and burn his body after parting it out? How could a parent ever do such a thing to carry out the will of God? This, after all, was Isaac, his only son. The son of his old age, the son of promise that God had said would come and miraculously did. The one that God said would be the heir, that he would carry out the covenant with. How could Abraham slay his son? How could this impossible command be followed? And yet we see, though the steps had to be painstaking, though the trip had to be very long and formidable, though the trek up the mountain had to seem perhaps like forever, Abraham carried out the impossible. Now, he didn't slay his son. It didn't end with his death. But Abraham went up that mountain with the belief and the knowledge and the understanding that he was coming back down the mountain with his son. He didn't know how. But he believed if he did as God said, then he would be what? He would be rewarded. What's that? Hebrews 11:6. Believe that God is a rewarder of those that faithfully diligently seek him. He believed that even if he slew him, he would come back down the mountain with him. He had that belief. And Abraham did the impossible. He did not withhold his only son from him. Look at verse number 11. He took forth his hand to slay his son. Verse 11, and the angel of the Lord called unto him out of heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, Here am I. He said, Lay not thine hand upon the lad, neither do thou anything unto him. For now I know that thou fearest God, seeing that thou hast not withheld thy son, that only son, from me. And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked and beheld, behind him a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him for a burnt offering in the stead of his son. God was pleased, the impossible was carried out. Abraham came back down the mountain with his son. Abraham accomplished the impossible in this situation. As we consider this impossible act and this impossible feat, how did he do it? How did he ever even begin to make the trip? How did he ever continue as he went? How did he ever bind his son? How did he ever pull back the knife and willingly in service to God, be ready to slay him? How could that ever be? Did he possess something we don't? Did he have access to something that we do not have access to? How is it that these were able to accomplish the impossible? The answer is that they didn't have anything that we don't have. Or in other words, we don't lack anything that these people had to accomplish the impossible. These feats were impossible. They were powerless to accomplish them on their own. So then, what made them successful? So then, what brought to them the ability or the power to accomplish that which otherwise they could not do? Of course, we could just say God and leave it at that. But there's a little more to it than that. A little more to it than that. They had a possession. They had something that was real. They had a substance. And they had some evidence. In other words, they had faith. And they walked by that faith. Remember Hebrews 10:38 from this morning? It tells us that the just shall live. The just shall walk by faith. Shall carry out their lives by faith. They walked by faith and not by sight. As we've already discovered today, faith is not a blind leap in the dark. It's not a blind commitment or a mere feeling of closeness to God. Faith is a substance. Faith is real. It is concrete. It is our foundation for action. Abraham had it. Oh, did he ever have it? And his faith was not on life support. His faith was not dwindling away or, you know, just as a candle over in the corner. But his faith was active. It was vibrant. It was alive. And when God said, go and do, Abraham had faith in God. He had a real substance to hang on to found his actions upon. He had real evidence that what God was saying was true and what he should do. Oh, he didn't understand. I'm not saying that. He didn't know why. He didn't understand the big picture of things. He didn't really know how it would come to pass. There's a lot he didn't know. But for all that Abraham didn't know, what he did know was what caused him to be successful here in the impossible. He was able to accomplish his task. Faith is real. Faith is concrete. It's our evidence of what is right, of who God is, of what he has always done. It is our evidence that God has always been and will always be faithful. That He is a diligent rewarder of those that seek Him. It's a substance that shows us that doing what God calls us to do is always the right thing, and being convinced of that to the point where you cannot stand still when God says go. David couldn't remain among the ranks of the weak and the powerless, of those shaking in their uniforms. Because God had called him to go. His faith was evidence to him that that was the right thing to do, and he could not stand still. It was a substance that founded his actions. How else could he say to the giant as he looked up to him, I come to you in the name of the Lord. You and all the armies of the Philistines are going to be destroyed. When our extremity meets God's demand for the impossible, the only thing that will bring success is faith in God. It's the only thing that will bring success. When God asks the impossible, our faith had better be active, alive, and vibrant and ready to accomplish the impossible. It's only through His power. So when people say God will not give you more than you can handle, truly He does, because we're powerless to do it ourselves. But by faith, it can be accomplished. By having this substance, by having this evidence, it can be accomplished. God asks us to do the impossible every single day. He calls us to live godly in this present evil world. That is impossible with men. But certainly by faith, it can be done. He calls us to be godly parents, to raise up a generation that is being raised in the fear and admonition of the Lord. That's impossible today with men. Why do you think so many are failing? It's a job that requires faith. It requires substance. It requires evidence to know that what we're doing is right. And no matter how hard it is, we just keep on doing it and keep on doing it and keep on doing it. He calls us every day to do the impossible, to overcome our nature and to be a good spouse, to love our husbands and our wives, to serve and to give 100% of ourselves no matter what, to live for them, to die for them, to give everything for them. They are our flesh and our bones. God calls us to the impossible. With men, it is impossible. I can't do it. But by faith, having that substance, having that evidence, it will carry us through. He directs us to serve Him in a multitude of ways, slaying giants, jumping into furnaces. And the only thing that will enable us is the substance and evidence of faith to slay those giants and to jump into those furnaces, to go up the mountain of sacrifice with our children, to do those things that God calls us to do that are impossible. This faith is a possession that enables us to live in this way and be successful. Go to Hebrews 11 as we conclude this evening. Well, let's back up and read in chapter 10, the verse we referenced a moment ago, Hebrews 10, verse 38. Now the just shall live by faith. Then, of course, in verse 1 of chapter 11, he defines what that faith is. The just shall live by substance of things hoped for. He shall live by evidence of things not seen. That's how we accomplish the impossible today. It's not within our abilities. It's not because of our standing, or it's not because of who we are. And that is why verse number 6 tells us that without faith it's impossible to please Him. That is true for salvation, of course. Can't be saved without faith. We're called to walk by faith. We're called to live by faith. And if your faith is not alive, active, and vibrant in answering the call of the impossible when God places it upon you, then we are not and cannot please God in our daily lives. We need to bring that faith to every day. Notice, we're told in this chapter, as you just scan down through, verse 7, by faith, verse 8, by faith, verse 9, by faith, we see verse 13, these all died in faith. As we look down through Hebrews chapter 11, verse 17, by faith, when he was tried, by faith Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac. And he that had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said that in Isaac shall thy seed be called, accounting that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead, from whence also he received him in a figure. Accounting that God. How did Abraham come to account that God would do such a thing? How did he account for that? Was it a blind leap saying, oh boy, I sure hope this works out, or Sarah's going to be pretty mad when I get back home? Was it a blind leap? A blind leap doesn't cause you to take your son up the mountain and prepare to slit his throat. That's not blind faith. That's not it at all. But he accounted that God was able to raise him up even from the dead. He did that by faith. Because his faith was substance. His faith was evidence of who God was. And that he was a rewarder of those that seek him. We notice down here, in verse number 21. By faith Jacob. Verse 22. By faith Joseph. And then notice in conclusion tonight. By faith Moses. By faith Moses. When he was born. So in other words, it's saying here. By substance of hope, by evidence of things not seen, Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents because they saw he was a proper child. They were not afraid of the king's commandment. So, verse number 23 is really speaking of the faith that Moses' parents had. Verse number 24, by faith Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. By faith. He was able to make that choice, that impossible decision. By substance, by evidence, Moses decided not to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, verse 25, choosing rather to suffer. What an impossible decision. To choose to suffer instead of enjoying the pleasures of sin for a season. And verse number 26 is so precious, esteeming the reproaches of Christ. Christ. Not the reproaches of God the Father, not the reproaches of the people of Israel, not the reproaches of those in that time, but the reproaches of Christ in the time of Moses. How did Moses know anything about Christ? By the substance, the evidence, that is faith. We notice here that he goes on to say in verse 27, by faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. For he endured, now notice this last part of this phrase, as seeing him who is invisible. Evidence of things not seen. Well, you just gotta love how it just keeps reaffirming to us how real this faith is. Our duty as a gift from God as it is given to us is to use it in our lives to do the impossible. When God calls us to do the impossible, we need to respond in faith. Respond in faith and believe that God will bless, God will work, not having any idea what that outcome may be. The Hebrew children didn't really know. And they evidenced that by saying, oh king, we're not anxious, we're not worried about it. You know, if you throw us into the furnace, fine, we'll be dead, but we have a compromise and we'll be with God. But we know also our God's able to deliver us, and He just may do that also. Either way, we're not bound down to your statue. I mean, you don't say that without some real substance. Without some real evidence. That's what this faith is. Let's stand. That's what the mighty musician